Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Heal You Naturally Wellness Podcast with me, your host, Astrid from healyounaturally.com. As usual, I chat about things disease prevention, nutrition, well-being, and my mission with this podcast is to help you get to the root cause of why you aren't feeling great, to reconnect with you, to feel happier, more joyful, and to be a little bit kinder to yourself. Because I think life, especially right now, can be hectic. This episode is sponsored by my ebook, Top 10 Foods for a Super Healthy Lymphatic System. You could find it at www.healyounaturally.com/ebook, or you could find it at the link in the show notes or below. I found the conversation really inspiring and lighthearted and funny, and I think you're really going to enjoy this podcast. I think what I took from this episode is that if you're genetically predisposed to certain chronic diseases, it is imperative to take action as soon as possible in order to reverse potential disease. As usual, I talk about prevention, and so that should be your first course of action. That being said, be kind to yourself, compassionate, and above all, love yourself. So I hope you're really well this week. And this week's guest needs no introduction. So without further ado. Hey, everyone. Welcome to the Heal Your Natural Wellness Podcast. Today, I have a phenomenal guest and his name is Dr. Benjamin Bigman. He earned his PhD in bioenergetics and was a postdoctoral fellow with the Duke National University of Singapore and metabolic disorders. Currently, he's professional focus as a scientist and associate professor at BYU is to better understand the role of elevated insulin in regulating obesity and diabetes, including the relevance of ketones in mitochondrial function. Welcome to the Heal Your Natural Wellness Podcast, Ben.
Oh, my pleasure, Astrid. Thanks so much for reaching out. You and I have exchanged a lot of little messages through social media, and now we've finally come together.
I know. It's an honor to have you. I'm a fan of forever. I love your work, and I think my audience is absolutely going to love it. A lot of them follow you, in fact, and they send some questions. They're very excited. A lot of questions, but I said I'm going to try to keep it short and sweet. So without further ado, let's go right in. Yeah. So why don't you briefly tell us about your journey as a scientist and professor fascinated with metabolism and disorders caused by insulin resistance?
Yeah. It was an interesting evolution. Well, everyone has an interesting evolution, and mine is interesting to me. So I was nearing the end of my undergraduate degree and very much having an early life crisis with regards to what I would do with my career, what I would do in my life. I was nearing the end of my degree in exercise science, and that is one of those degrees that I enjoyed. It was something I was interested in, the body and how it adapts to exercise. But I was pragmatic enough to realize this is not a practical degree. It's not the kind of degree where there's a set job at the back end of it. And I was taking a class with a professor who was an active scientist as well. He maintained a research lab at the university, and he studied muscle physiology, muscle cell physiology. And it was so interesting for me to hear him bring in the experiments and the work that he was doing in his lab as he would teach us about some of these concepts. And it was enlightening because I didn't know that there were scientists still studying the body. I was so naive. I thought, we know everything there is to know about the body, and anything that has to do with science is going to be in the realms of chemistry or engineering and technology. I didn't think there was still kind of human relevant biology research happening. It was happening. It still is happening. But that knowledge combined with my natural curiosity led me to pursue graduate studies and then postdoctoral work, focusing on the human body. And then it was nearing the end of my master's degree where I became interested in insulin and insulin resistance, because it is, and at the time was looked at as the clear connection between body fat and diabetes. So those kind of twin epidemics of obesity and diabetes, insulin resistance is what bridges the gap between those two. And so that planted a seed of interest in the early kind of mid 2000s that has only grown as my knowledge of the topic has grown. So it's my enthusiasm has been matched by my knowledge. And that brings me up to my current point, being an independent scientist running my own lab.
Oh, that's phenomenal. You know, it's very interesting that you're talking about this, because when you were saying about the studies and scientists, I actually thought the same. I thought the science was settled. I never thought that there were, I mean, it's silly to think that they're not constantly investigating and researching, yeah. But I actually thought, you know, it's pretty much settled. But I find it fascinating. I think you're actually one of the only scientists that I know in the industry who are so focused on metabolism and insulin resistance, which is such a gift, because like you said, it's an epidemic. Mm-hmm. I've personally dealt with it. You know, I try to be as transparent as I can with my audience, what I do. And, you know, despite some people, in which we're going to get into, some people try to lead a healthier lifestyle, well, because of genetics and things like that, it's a little bit difficult, but it's definitely doable. And that's why I have Ben here with us, because he's going to break it all down. Nobody better than him. So we're going to go right into the questions. So Ben, why don't we talk about insulin resistance, fasting, and the latest science on both, but mainly insulin resistance, because you're the guy for this.
Yeah. So you said it well, by way of kind of bringing up the topic more explicitly of insulin resistance. It is the single most common health disorder probably in the world, and most certainly in the United States. And many other countries are even worse than the United States, like Mexico and almost all of the Middle East. This is an incredible problem. Unfortunately, most people, neither do they know that they have insulin resistance, and they don't even know what it is. So insulin resistance is just this growing disorder of you have more and more of the hormone insulin in the body, and some of the cells aren't working very well responding to it. So those two events are happening concurrently. There are two sides of the same coin. And we have to understand that to understand how insulin resistance is leading to or increasing the risk of virtually every chronic disease, what I like to call the plagues of prosperity. And it ranges from things like Alzheimer's disease, like a dementia, to heart disease, to infertility, to hypertension, fatty liver disease, and certain skin disorders, and more and more and more. Almost every chronic disease that someone's thinking of listening to me right now probably is some way either caused or accelerated by insulin resistance. So it's the most common disorder. It plays into almost every other chronic disease, and most people don't even know they have it.
Wow. Yes. I actually was looking at one of your images, which we're going to talk about a little later on, and it's a very good visual. And guys, you could go to Ben's Instagram, will you see, and I'm going to mention everything at the end of the podcast. And you could see that this was really an eye opener when I look at that image that we have at the bottom of our little script.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's on the insulin IQ page.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so it's like type 2 diabetes, all the stroke, all of this, and then Alzheimer's. So it's extremely important that now that we're talking about it, go and have your insulin resistance levels checked. I didn't know the difference. So because of my history, both my grandparents diabetic, maternal, my parents diabetic, they had complications. Oh. Daddy passed away in 2015 of diabetes complications, which we never thought. And he was not overweight. My father was probably about 130 pounds.
Oh,
small. Yeah, he wasn't heavy. He always took the stairs, you know, instead of, he would park far away. It was such a sad thing because my dad tried, but mm-hmm. because of the way he was with conventional, unfortunately, conventional medicine didn't, I feel that sometimes doesn't address what we always talk about, the root cause, right? So, you know, the medications, this, that. But where I'm going with this is I didn't know the difference between your morning glucose or mm-hmm. testing your sugar, your glucose versus insulin. So yeah. I asked my doctor a couple of years ago, can you write a prescription for me? And she's like, it's not really important.
Yep.
I had watched what you said, and I said, it's very important you run the test because I need to know. So, you know, if you're listening to this, definitely be on top of that, because you see how it could affect you. It be affecting you in whatever conditions you're dealing with, if you are dealing with any. So thank you for answering that.
Well, in fact, you bring up some wonderful points there that I just can't help but touch on very quickly.
Yes, go.
So as someone's progressing towards type 2 diabetes, unfortunately, just like you just explained, we look at type 2 diabetes as a glucose problem. And so every year the person's coming in, we're looking at their glucose, and we see that, okay, you're gaining weight, your blood pressure is going up, maybe you have fertility problems or whatever, but your glucose is normal, and so you're fine. And then years later, they start to see the glucose climb, and then they say, oh, wait a minute, now you're pre-diabetic. Oh, wait a minute, now you're diabetic. Unfortunately, if we had been looking at the insulin throughout this entire timeline, we would have detected that while the glucose was staying normal for years, maybe decades, the insulin had been going up. It's 2 times higher, it's 3 times mm-hmm. higher, it's 4 times higher. And then it's only once the body becomes so resistant to insulin, and one of insulin's main effects is to lower blood glucose, now it can't keep the glucose in check. So the body is swimming in a sea of insulin that can't work as well, and now the glucose starts to climb, and then we detect the problem, and then all we want to do is try to lower the glucose. Unfortunately, so... one very important takeaway from that is by ignoring the insulin, we don't detect the insulin resistance as early as we could. We wait until, in some instances, it's gone very, very far down the road where the glucose has now risen substantially. And that's just, it's not that it's irreversible. It is. It's just going to take a lot longer and a lot harder to turn that car around. But then also in the case of your dad, it's interesting to note the ethnic differences, where some ethnicities will become more insulin resistant and then diabetic much more quickly, including Hispanic ethnicities, very much so. And Asian as well, and Asian Indian, some ethnicities just go that diabetic route much, much sooner, with much less body fat on the body than other ethnicities do. But it also reflects how terrible the dietary advice has been for so long. We have known since the 1980s that if you take people with type 2 diabetes, like your father, and we say you need to eat a diet that is adhering to the American Diabetes Association, which is a low fat, high carbohydrate, high in whole grains and, you know, whatever they, this, a little bit of sugar. We've known since 1987, a scientist did a clinical study on type 2 diabetics and found that when they put them perfectly to the letter of a diet, to the ADA diet, they got worse.
Absolutely.
That's because if you tell a diabetic that they need to focus on carbohydrates as their main source of calories, you're just putting more in their body of what is the very thing that's causing the problem.
Oh, absolutely. It's such a burden. And in fact, you know, it's interesting that you bring this. Actually, before I go and talk about this, it's actually not that important, but I was going to say, you know, the way the system is broken when daddy unfortunately ended up with some toes amputated and one after the other and after below the knee. When I went to rehab in Atlanta, Georgia, rehab place, I have to talk about this. They were feeding snacks, the sweet crackers, cookies and
it's
crackers
insane.
And also the door. And I was telling the girl, don't give him that. Don't even show it. And I try to talk to the head nutritionist or the nutritionist. And I'm like, what are they feeding my dad after an amputation from diabetes? Fried chicken, a ton of carrots, and I believe mashed potatoes. And I said, why are you feeding him this? What are you trying? So anyways.
Honestly, Astrid, I can only think the reason that terrible dietary advice has persisted. This sounds terrible of me to say, but I'm going to say it. It's cynical, I know, but it's a wonderful way to sell more medication.
Thank you.
I know it's a cynical view.
No.
And I don't have data to confirm that view, but I can only think that this is so obviously harmful that there has to be an ulterior motive, and the motive must be money. which is the motive behind so many things.
You're 100% on the money. And I've talked about this, and I'm not afraid to say I've spoken about it for years because of raising awareness. The pharmaceutical industry, there's no, you're 100% right. And I've said it before, and it's the reality. And they don't, they go to your accounts and they leave comments and shills, whatever, but it's the reality. There's an ulterior motive. And so it has to change. That's why we do what we do. That's part of what I do. So I just wanted to ask you, so two things in one, kind of. What if you have a patient who's insulin resistant, has insulin resistance and does not have high blood pressure? And if this is a patient who already got too far with the insulin resistance where their sugars are in the 200s or let's say higher, how do they reverse this? What is like one of the most effective ways to do it without medication? Because the first thing that doctors say is metformin and two more different medications.
Yep. You're right. Yep. So type 2 diabetes and insulin resistance, which precedes type 2 diabetes always, that is essentially a disease of diet. Now, there's a genetic predisposition. So if Astrid, the bad news for you, and this isn't news, you, of course, because you have immediate family relatives who had type 2 diabetes, you will absolutely struggle more with type 2 diabetes than say I will. I have a family history of other diseases that worry me, like cancer, for example, but it's almost impossible that I'd get type 2 diabetes. I would have to try to get it. Because it is very much a genetic, it's not that there's a clear set of genes, but there's a clear familial inheritance and risk to type 2 diabetes. So that's the bad news. The good news is you can still control it to some degree, where we published a case study about 2 years ago where we took 11 women that with full-blown type 2 diabetes and without ever taking a single pill, without a single medication, in 90 days, they had no clinical evidence. Their HbA1c was normal. Their glucose was normal. Their blood pressure got normal. Their blood lipids got better, and they lost about 20 pounds. And we only did that through a low-carbohydrate diet. It was a clinical situation, so it was well-controlled, but not a single pill popped. In fact, that was the conversation. The physician, a friend of mine and co-author on that paper, basically the conversation in his clinic when he would meet with this woman and say, oh boy, you're a type 2 diabetic. All of these ladies, he would say, you leave the office with a prescription for medication you will never get off of. You will only have to take more and more of it because that's the unspoken truth. If you leave with medication being your strategy for type 2 diabetes, it will never solve the problem. So you'll be on that drug forever. And that, because that is the conventional treatment, that is why people say type 2 diabetes is irreversible.
Right.
Because if you are using medication to try to fight it,
you never get better.
You will never get better. You will always simply be treating symptoms of the disease. If, however, you say this is a diet problem, let's change your diet. Now you are literally addressing the single point of origin of the disease, and you can reverse it. So even if you have someone who is full-blown diabetic, it is very, very likely. And of course, Astrid and I aren't giving medical advice here, but talk to your doctor, but it is very, very likely you can get off all of your diabetes-related medications. So in fact, if you have a type 2 diabetic who's on diabetic medications and hypertensive medications, they typically will have to get off their hypertensive medications within the first week or two because their blood pressure drops so quickly. And then over the next few weeks and months, they get off their diabetes medications very commonly. So it is reversible, thank goodness. And because the food we eat is the cause or the consequence, it's the culprit or the cure.
Absolutely. Yeah, that is so true. And like for me, for example, like you said, with genetics, when I first came to America, because I'm Colombian, as many of them know, So things were normal, I'm a former athlete, whatever. But when I came here was when things started changing. So when I noticed that both my parents were diabetic, I started watching. But what did I do then? I was using the Equal. I remember Equal is what they used. I said, oh, you know what? I got to watch. I didn't know any better. I just started college at that time and like that. And I had just gotten here. So I said, let me get on the diet. My parents were eating whole wheat breads and whole wheat this, the rice that is the brown rice.
Yep.
And as I learned, anything whole wheat is, and correct me if I'm wrong, everything that is whole wheat has a higher glycemic impact or index compared to the regular grains, yeah, which are not good either. Is that true?
Well, I don't know if it's higher, but it's generally as bad as. It's going to be usually as high as. It may have 1 gram of fiber more or so, and fiber generally will lower the glycemic load, but it's not enough to make a difference. And so it is the myth that you eat whole grain bread and that's going to be somehow better for the diabetic than just white bread. It isn't. They still, if they have a continuous glucose monitor on, they see this and they can never unsee it. Their glucose will spike, get up into the 200s, and then take hours to come back down. Whether it was white bread or brown bread, it doesn't make a difference. But that's part of the myth.
Oh, there you go, guys. So now you know either or. And that's actually something that I've learned. One of the ways, another one of my issues, which I wanted to touch on real quick, because perhaps there's another person that's dealing with this. So with me is, I've always been a night owl, mm-hmm, type of thing, especially when I started doing web development. You work a lot at night doing the coding because it's quiet and whatever. And so my issue, I think, with the prediabetes is because I may have induced, based on what I've read, insulin resistance because of the lack of sleep, which we're going to get to that question. I think I have something like that. I'm sorry. I don't want to deviate for that. Or maybe we could talk about that question, mm-hmm, which is, let's see, what is the best way to reverse insulin resistance? I think we kind of talked about that. Diet more than anything.
So let me be explicit. So low carb diet and fasting. And you'd mentioned fasting earlier, and I'd just forgotten to address it. Low carb diet and fasting work the best because it lowers the insulin the fastest. And that's the key, because in most instances of insulin resistance, the chronically elevated insulin from constantly eating starchy snacks all the time, that is what's driving the insulin resistance. Too much insulin is a primary cause of insulin resistance. And so you lower the insulin, and then the insulin resistance starts to get resolved. Now, you bring up sleep deprived or lack of sleep induced insulin resistance. That plays into one of the other three causes of insulin resistance. So the primary causes of insulin resistance are too much insulin. I think that's the biggest one. And then inflammation. If someone has, and people use the term inflammation a lot, and so I'll be very precise here. With inflammation, I mean like autoimmune diseases. If someone has rheumatoid arthritis, for example, when the rheumatoid arthritis is active, insulin resistance will be there. When the autoimmune disease subsides, so too does the insulin resistance. So it very much follows that immune pattern. And then lastly, the other primary cause is stress. And that brings us to sleep and insomnia, because if you are sleep deprived, you have elevated levels of the stress hormones, especially cortisol. And we know this, it's very well documented, and epinephrine or adrenaline, the other stress hormone. If you don't get enough sleep, cortisol and epinephrine are both significantly elevated the next day. Those two hormones cause insulin resistance in the body, independent of any other signal. You just bump up the cortisol, bump up the epinephrine, and now the person starts to become more insulin resistant. So in your situation where you were chronically sleep deprived, you would have been exacerbating your already genetic tendency to become insulin resistant. You were basically just sprinkling a little fuel on the fire.
Ay, ay, ay. Yes. And now for those of you who are still, younger and able to, because when we're younger, we're like, oh, I could stay up and work and do whatever, but it'll inevitably affect you later on. And now I'm actually working on reversing all of that. In fact, I just started taking melatonin and whatever to try to help me, because I realized, and I have a team now, I realized that I wasn't able to do it on my own in terms of, because I tend to eat healthier. I know that I could be, and I am now, more low carb, but I have been even for years, and I've always worked out. I love working out. I'm always out there walking, whatever. But my cortisol levels are off the charts. I just got the Dutch test, which I recommend for you guys too. I don't know if there's something else that you recommend in terms of, no. Okay, cool. So to check your hormones. And so, that's important. Very good. Thank you for answering that. Now we're going to move hormones, obviously related metabolism, but a little bit on the other side. So you have a really good post, like all of your posts on social media. How does about estrogen and fat storage? And yeah. this this is pretty awesome because, like you wrote, sex hormones control many processes in the body, and estrogens have multiple and diverse effects on telling the body where and how to store fat. These are Dr. Ben's words. So how does estrogen affect fat storage, and what can women do about it?
So let's maybe, I'll start with the second part of that. There's nothing a woman can do about it. Estrogens are going to be what estrogens are going to be. So premenopausal, they're going to have that natural ebb and flow. So prepubertal, so in childhood, estrogens are very low. And then the reason a little girl starts to look like a woman physically is because her estrogens, because she starts to go as she's nearing puberty and then getting into puberty, her estrogen level from the ovaries goes up. I don't know exactly. I think it's 100 or 1,000 times over where they had been. There's this massive increase in estrogens. And now for the rest of her fertile life, for the next 30 years, she's going to have that ebb and flow of estrogens during the menstrual cycle. But even at its low, it's still going to be higher than it was during childhood. And estrogens, of course, independent of anything else related to fertility, estrogens will increase the propensity to store fat. They will actually activate certain enzymes in certain parts of the body, like the breasts, the butt, and the hips, where most women store most of their fat. That is because of estrogens. Estrogens tell the body where to store fat. And then second to that is it tells the body how to store fat. And by that, I mean the body, when fat tissue is growing, when we have more to pinch and jiggle and hug and cuddle with, then the fat tissue is growing through two different ways. One is that each individual fat cell is set in its number. We're not making more fat cells, but each fat cell itself is getting much, much bigger. Alternatively, each fat cell gets a little big, and then we make a new fat cell. And then it gets a little big and we make a new fat cell. That's called hyperplasia. So we have two, and the other one was called hypertrophy. So we have two ways of getting fat, hypertrophy versus hyperplasia. Estrogens tell the body to store fat through hyperplasia. Now, estrogens aren't telling the body to store fat. That's what some people misunderstood. Estrogens are not fattening. They do not help the body store fat. They just tell the body, if the body is saying, I need to store fat, and it would do that because insulin is elevated. Insulin is what tells the body to store more fat. Mm. Estrogens now will say, okay, insulin, you've given us our marching orders. You want us to store more fat. We are now telling the body to store fat through hyperplasia. Not hypertrophy. And hyperplasia is a healthy way to get fat. So if you are getting fat through hyperplasia, that will typically mean that you stay insulin sensitive. And so metabolically speaking, you get fatter, but you actually stay healthy despite that fat. Now, eventually you could reach a point where you've gone beyond that, and it's very harmful metabolically. But that is why women are fatter than men. They're supposed to be fatter than men for fertility's sake. Women need more fat just to be fertile than a man does. But it's because her estrogens are telling her body to get fat through hyperplasia, as opposed to the man who's getting mostly fat generally through hypertrophy. So a man and a woman, they get married, they're both gaining 10 pounds a year. And the woman will typically be healthy. Her blood pressure is normal. Her blood lipids are normal. Even though she's as fat as her husband or a little fatter, he's getting much sicker because of it. His blood pressure is going up. His blood lipids, his triglycerides are going up. His HDL is going down. All of these harmful trends. So estrogens help the woman be fatter, but healthier than her male counterpart who doesn't have those high levels of estrogens. And then, of course, as the woman is reaching the end of her fertile years and gets into menopause, now the estrogens have plummeted. And so if her body is still trying to store fat because the insulin is high and insulin's forcing that fat storage, now she can't store fat through hyperplasia anymore because the estrogens have come down. Now she starts to store fat more through hypertrophy, because the estrogens aren't kind of protecting that fat storage mechanism anymore. And now she starts to suffer more from prediabetes and hypertension and dyslipidemia and so on.
Wow, that's fascinating. You see, I always heard of that women having that extra layer of fat.
Yep.
So this is where it comes from, guys. Dr. Ben pretty much broke it down for us. So one thing that I wanted to ask is if you have for example, one of the questions that somebody sends me, I think it said, which I kind of have as well from what I learned from my previous test, was high cortisol levels mm-hmm. and also high estrogen levels.
Mm. Yeah.
What do you think is like one of the best ways to kind of like either reverse that or mm-hmm. at least lower everything to a degree that is going to not affect your health?
Yeah. So I would, I'm speculating a little. I would say don't worry at all about the high estrogens. It's very likely that they're in a totally normal range. Estrogens are naturally in a huge range from one healthy woman to the next. Estrogen levels can be several times higher in one woman than another woman, and there's nothing wrong about that. So don't worry about the high estrogens. The high cortisol is something to take note of simply because chronically elevated cortisol will make the body insulin resistant. It does make our fat cells insulin resistant as well. Very specifically, it affects how and where we store fat. It basically takes this female pattern of fat storage, which is where women typically store fat away from the belly more than at the belly. And cortisol wants to push that fat to be stored more centrally, right around the belly, and strip it from areas like the butt and hips, which is like the healthiest place to store it. So the elevated cortisol is going to be metabolically damaging and relevant, not the high estrogens. And if someone is looking at their cortisol and is worried about it, it's a hard thing to do. That's why I typically don't start by saying stress is a key cause of insulin resistance, even though it does play into it. It's just because it's so hard to control stress. You know, you and I can say this and say, well, you need to have better sleep habits. And someone listening would say, well, great, thanks. Now I'm going to even worry more about my sleep. And, you know, so, or we say you're too stressed. You need to control your relationships at home better. Well, great. Thanks. What do you do if you have an abusive spouse or kids that are insane all the time? So those are the variables. Cortisol is a variable that is very, very hard to really firmly control, push it up or push it down. I would say a person would be maybe best served by trying to improve sleep habits. And if I were to leave someone with what I think is the single most relevant variable to improve their sleep, I would say don't eat after dinner. You eat dinner early, eat around 6 o'clock. I'd say no later if you can, and then don't eat another single bite of food after that. I have seen it in myself and others that the biggest variable that determines a good night or a bad night of sleep is not eating in the evening.
Yeah, I fully agree with that. And actually just learned something recently, which it makes total sense. And I'm sure a lot of people knew this before, but it's like first of all, when you don't eat at night, you're going to be practicing a little bit of intermittent fasting. Mm-hmm. And I also, because I've been testing for years, I test my numbers. And if I have a snack at night, without a doubt, the next day, or if I don't, when I fast and I go for a walk after dinner, I definitely notice a change in my numbers the next day.
Oh, so, same. And I'm not diabetic, not pre-diabetic. I will wear a continuous glucose monitor very often. I'm curious about my own health and well-being. And even me, I will see if I have indulged in carbs late in the evening the night before, my glucose levels will be like this all night. And then when I wake up in the morning, they will boop, they'll take a big jump. If I have eaten a good low-carb dinner the night before and fasted after that, then it'll be low the whole night. And when I wake up in the morning, it doesn't even blip. Maybe a teeny little blip, but it just moves along just as low as it was before.
I know. It's fascinating. Another thing that I learned while I was pregnant, because, I had a nutritionist and whatever. And I actually learned that if you eat, say, French fries or like a carb combination with bad fat, your sugars will stay continuously higher.
Yep.
Within literally the next 24 hours.
Yeah. So that's one of the truths of mixing macronutrients. If someone eats pure carbohydrate, there'll be a huge spike and it'll start to drop really quickly. And then you'll go low very, very often. You'll have a low point where you feel miserable. And then you come back up to where you were before. If you eat the carbs with fat, it won't go as high as that peak. It'll be much more gradual, but then it'll stay high for hours, hours, hours.
Yeah, that's pretty
don't mix the two. Carbs and fat are not supposed to come together. In nature, they don't come together. The only exception to that is dairy. Dairy is high in fat and carb and protein, so it's a perfect cocktail to help grow a little baby. And that is why in nature, the only time a mammal is making milk is when the mama mammal is feeding baby mammal. And that's perfect because it's going to accelerate. It's the perfect thing. It's high in all three macros. After milk, there's nothing else that's high in carb and fat together. Right. But it's a delicious combination, which is why packaged processed foods will put the two together, because it gives you this something that is that sweet, gooey, or that kind of very yummy, kind of salty, crunchy with some fat.
Yeah, there's science to that. But you know, that'll be like for another podcast. You know, they design these foods to make them literally addictive. Yep. Excellent. Thank you for answering that. Let's move to another question. So one of your posts you had, which is something that it's interesting for me because I literally eat eggs every day. I need some protein to feel satiated in because I can't have the carbs. Eggs is what I rely on. Like I would pick eggs anytime before oatmeal. And the reason why I mentioned this is because I know a few people that feel the same way. Society, I can say that word.
Yep. Satiety. I agree completely.
Right. So for me, protein. So are eggs healthy? So there was a recent study published, an article published in the British Journal of Nutrition. And I got this from Dr. Ben's post that suggested that eating one egg per day will increase your risk of diabetes. Why don't you tell us some of the flaws of this study?
Yeah.
And how it compared to others in your bottom line regarding egg consumption.
Yeah. So bottom line is eggs are always on the menu. They are, I think, God's most perfectly packaged mix of protein and fat, packaged so nicely. And it's a 1-to-1 ratio of protein to fat. Everything about it, the yolk and the egg white, eat it often, and you're going to be better off. And that is based on the clinical studies. So, and I'll get to that study you mentioned. So there's two ways nutritional studies have been done in the past and are done. There are correlational studies, or there are clinical studies. A clinical study is a study that actually takes a group of people and say, you're going to eat like this for the next several months, and you are going to eat like this. And in those studies that have said, okay, group, treatment group, you now got to eat 4 extra eggs per day or whatever it is, those always show improvements in health. So the clinical studies, the actual studies that can prove cause and effect, suggest that eggs are helping create a healthier body. Now, the correlational studies, the other type of study that is done in nutritional science, is a study where you just ask people questions. You just come to people and say, here's a questionnaire. Here's a survey. Tell me what kind of foods you eat. Well, there's all kinds of problems with that. Right. The person has to remember. You have to rely on their own memory of how are they eating. They want to lie. They don't want to be honest. They don't. They want to make it sound like they're doing better than they are. So those kinds of things are always just filled with flaws. That study was so interesting because they only found that the women had that egg phenomenon, where they found that it was the woman, not the men, in that study. When women ate more eggs, they tended to have a higher risk of diabetes, not the men. Now, interestingly, the way they determined the number of eggs people ate, where they would ask them how much egg containing, air quotes, how much egg containing foods are you eating, including baked goods. And they noted in the study that women tended to eat more cakes and cookies and just treats. And well, wouldn't you know it, you use eggs to bake those cakes. And so that's how they were determining it. So there's this huge confounding variable, which is, what else are you eating with the egg? Oh, lots of flour, lots of sugar, lots of cooking oil. Well, that's all garbage. It's not the egg. Don't blame the egg for what the flour and the sugar did. But they did.
That's fascinating. And when I was listening to this, doing a little research before the podcast, it's like, you know, you got to be careful with these studies, you know, and I actually learned something new from you, the difference between the clinical studies
and the correlational.
It's only questions and you can't really get much data like that. So, okay. So eat your eggs. Like I always say, guys, pastured, organic, aim for that. I know that sometimes you say financially you can't, but you're investing in your health and you always win with that. So thank you for answering that. We're going to move to the next question. Let's see. Since we're talking about food, this is something that I also learned, as always from you, a little bit. So I restrict fruit, and I was listening to your recent live with someone from this really nice lady from Dubai, I believe. And you, I was listening to the live while I was doing something, and you were mentioning the fruits that you feel, which some of my listeners could be potentially consuming, you know, mango, banana. Mm-hmm. I stay away from banana, mangoes. I learned that one medium mango equals one cup of sugar. I don't know if that's accurate, but I was like mind blown, and I know that. So let's talk about whole fruit. Mm-hmm. And because I think it's important, as you know, in the industry, there is the different diets and stuff like that. And like I always talk about with me, it's never been about a follow a diet. It's a lifestyle, and whatever works for you, whatever works for your family. That's what I always advocate for, you know, whatever works for you, and keep it healthy. So
yeah,
whole fruit juices. Tell us a little bit.
Yeah, sure. Sure. So in general, when someone wants to, if someone were to leave our conversation today and say, okay, I want to try a low carb diet, I typically give it certain tiers, or what's the first step of a low carb diet. And to me, the first step is focus on fruits and vegetables. And I just kind of leave it at that, but eat them, don't drink them. And I'll get into that part now. But that's the simplest step to get into a low carb diet. And then when someone has done that and they've improved, now they reach a new plateau, they say, okay, now what? Then I say, okay, now you avoid the most sugary of the fruits and the starchiest of the vegetables. And the sugary fruits are the ones you just mentioned. They're the tropical fruits like pineapples, bananas, mangoes. Nowadays, it also includes things like apples, where we've hybridized, we've grown, we've, I mean, there's nothing natural about the fruits we eat nowadays.
No.
If you look at what bananas used to be and compare them to now, it's laughable. If you look at what apples used to be and compare them to the apples we have now, as opposed to 100 years ago, we have fundamentally changed the nature of these fruits. They are much, much more sugary than they used to be. So those sugary fruits, they are the biggest offenders: bananas, pineapples, mangoes. And then you start kind of going down, and eventually you get to the point where berries constitute the majority of the fruits you're going to eat, if you eat any fruits. Fruits are not essential, neither are vegetables, but they can certainly be a healthy and enjoyable part of a smart diet. So I'm not telling people they can't eat them. I'm not telling people anything. But if I were talking to a type 2 diabetic, I would say you got to cut your fruit, because you give a diabetic a banana and they're going to see a big rise in their glucose, and then it'll come back down. And just avoid it. Just cut out the banana. So
just have berries, you know, like
that's right. Focus on berries.
You just have lower in, yeah, right.
Yep. Sorry, that's right. So, but eat them, don't drink them. when you drink, say the juice from apple, as much as an apple alone is going to increase your glucose, and it will, but if you drink apple juice, oh my goodness, now you're getting just pure water and fructose.
Sugar.
Mm-hmm. And the liver is going to rapidly convert a lot of that fructose into glucose, and you are going to get a huge increase in your glucose levels. And you've robbed out the fiber. And nature has these fruits and vegetables come with fiber. And if there's ever a reason to eat fiber, it's because you're eating other starches or sugars, because fiber will help blunt the effect of the glucose. So when you eat an apple, you're going to get a bump in glucose. If you drink apple juice, you're going to get a much, much bigger bump, in part because you've stripped out the fiber when you're drinking that apple rather than eating it. And you're just getting a lot more of the sugar and just the water, which is delicious, but it's terrible. So fruit juice is an absolute racket. Don't drink it. Don't give it to your kids. You're not doing anyone in your family any favors. You got to just try to wean your kids off the juice and focus on milk and water for your kids.
Wow. That's a really good point. And you know, with my son, because of that little bit of that fear of our history, at an early age, I always encouraged him when he wanted a candy, it would be sure you could have something sweet. I'm sorry. Sure.
Yeah.
Let's go to the refrigerator, strawberries, blueberries, raspberries, all the berries, maybe an apple, maybe occasionally oranges, tangerines, things like that. So, so I was just going to ask for someone who is trying to keep their insulin resistance at bay, or you know, working on reversing it. Fruits you just said some of the fruits are berries and stuff like that. What are other type of foods that will be beneficial in terms of reversing type of thing.
Yeah. So I have three ideas related to each of the three macronutrients. First step is control carbohydrates, like we've been talking about now. Cut out the sugar, cut out the grains, focus on fruits and vegetables and the least sugary of the fruits or starchy of the fruits and vegetables. And then second, prioritize protein. Make sure you're getting a lot of high quality protein. And by high quality, I mean animal protein. There's no debating that. By every metric, animal protein is superior to plant protein. Don't waste your time or money or health on plant protein. It's not worth it. Go animal. That is how humans are built. And there's no getting around that. As popular as it is to say that animal protein is bad or animal fat is bad, it's just wrong.
I'm sorry to cut you off on that. I just have to, because I have you on here and I've gotten this question online. There is a couple of accounts where they encourage a plant that you would reverse diabetes with a full plant-based, and they encourage a lot of fruit. So I was watching one of their things and I'm watching all the fruits and all of that. Yeah. Is this because of caloric restriction that they're doing?
Great question.
I said, that's got to be the only reason. How I was watching all these fruits and they're in this retreat in the Caribbean or whatever, and there's pineapple, mangoes. I was like, oh no. So tell me about that.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Gladly. So the strategy that I'm outlining right now with low, control your carbohydrates, prioritize protein, and don't fear fat. Those are my three rules. That is a strategy that is based on the low insulin approach, but you are bringing up a different approach, which is the low energy approach. So insulin resistance and all the problems that come with it are really a confluence of two problems. You have too much energy in your body, too much fat specifically, and you have too much insulin. Both of those are playing into insulin resistance, and both of them on their own can contribute to the insulin resistance. And so the solution then is to say, all right, this is caused by too much insulin and too much energy or fat. I'm going to control one or both of these. By going on a plant-based diet, you are choosing to focus on the low energy approach, because if you are plant-based, you are going to be low calorie almost always, especially if it's whole plant, whole food, plant-based. You are just not going, you're going to be calorie, low calorie. That isn't bad in its own right, but if you go low calorie or low energy, you will improve your insulin resistance because you're addressing one of the problems. However, there will be a diminishing returns that happens and it is not sustainable. And the problem, if you start your strategy with low energy, hunger always wins. Yes. So if you are forcing yourself into this calorie deprived, low calorie hunger state, hunger will win. And whatever improvements you get, you will undo them all as soon as your discipline breaks. Yep. During that retreat, sure, you'll have incredible improvements. You can't sustain it because it is hunger-based. That low energy means your hunger is going to be working against you every moment. And you're going to be slowly becoming more and more deficient in nutrients like iron, like vitamin B12, like omega-3 fatty acids for your brain. You cannot get those from plants. And so it is literally not sustainable. You will die. I mean, to the point that you will die, honest to goodness, let alone try to be fertile and nurse a baby or whatever else. You will harm your baby in doing it. There are actual studies to prove this. So the further someone gets from animal foods, the more nutrient deprived they become. So rather than focusing on the low energy approach, my philosophy, and this bears out with the human clinical data, go on the low insulin approach. That is why a low carbohydrate diet will lower insulin and improve insulin sensitivity more than a low fat diet does. Even when you've controlled for calories, you put them on the same calorie diet, the low carb wins. And so I go with the science. Everyone says that these days. Everyone says we believe in science. And I'm not saying that, because once you claim belief in some scientific view, you stop being a scientist. So I will just say the low carb evidence is superior to the evidence in favor of a low fat diet. Not that the low fat plant-based whole food can't work. It can, but it will not work as well as the low insulin approach. And good luck keeping up with it.
it's not sustainable. Wow, that was phenomenal. You know, for those of you who are on the plant, we always encourage definitely plant, mm-hmm. plants and vegetables. That should be like one of your priorities. But you know, we're not going to get into that. That'll be a whole other topic. Yeah,
it can't be the basis of the diet.
It can't. Because
humans literally have zero biological need for anything carbohydrate. Any plant, as healthy as we say it may be, it is absolutely not essential. So to me, it just seems bonkers to focus on the one macronutrient, carbohydrates, fat, and protein, the one macronutrient, carbohydrates, that is neither essential to humans, we literally don't need to eat it to survive, and second, it has the biggest effect on insulin. It is just... it defies reason to have that be the focus of the strategy to improve insulin resistance.
100% anecdotal. I've proven it time after time. When I don't go fully low carb, even while taking supplements, it doesn't really do anything. If I'm still kind of like mid carb, like a little bit high, not high carb, but kind of like higher, it's not, you know, it doesn't help me. All right. Just real quick. Resistant starches, because we're going to move to another question or you have to go. Just real quick on resistant starches. That's something that is, to me, it always confuses me, because I know that plantains, potatoes, yuca, the cassava thing, I think it's called cassava. Yeah. Those things spike your sugars like nobody's business. Resistant starches.
Yeah. So resistant starch isn't something, if I understand it correctly, I think you can take something like a potato and like twice bake it or something. I don't remember what it is, where you can convert some of the starches into resistant starches. So a resistant starch is simply another word for fiber. So if you have something that has a high glucose potential, like polysaccharides from like the starches in potatoes, those starches can come in two forms. One is going to be a form that just gets metabolized into glucose or blood sugar. Another will be a form that is actual fiber. Now, a straight potato, if you've baked your potato or boiled it, you've allowed the body to digest much of it, which is why there will be a big glucose spike. But if you, I know there are some clever things you can do to potatoes, like if you twice bake it or something like that.
Let it cool off.
I don't remember what it is.
Yeah, the rice, you kind of wash it a few times and it gets rid of the starch or whatever.
And then you have relatively more fiber or resistant starch. Uh-huh. And now it's just more fiber as a ratio to the glucose starch. And so when you eat that now, the glucose just doesn't go as high as it did before.
Gotcha. All right. So that answers my question. Thank you so much. Now we're going to move on to our last question. You have in one of your posts, be a fat burner. You have this really good video, which you guys have to go watch. A key to long-term weight control is to burn fat better. And you go on to discuss. So why don't you tell us the most effective ways to burn fat, especially for those of us who have trouble doing so. I want the secret because I've been trying for a long time.
Yeah. Well, you'll be a little disappointed because you're already doing it, but the body is a hybrid engine. At any moment, it's getting its energy from glucose or fats, well, and fats really. The degree to which we're predominantly burning one or the other, whether we're sugar burning or fat burning, is entirely a consequence of insulin. Insulin dictates what fuel the body is using. If insulin is up, the body's in sugar burning mode. If insulin's down, the body's in fat burning mode. And so the key to being a fat burner, so to speak, is to keep insulin low. Whether it's through fasting or low carbohydrate diets, the old adage, we used to say you are what you eat. The truth of it really is you burn what you eat. And if you're primarily eating your calories from starches, glucose, or glucose and carbs, then that's what you're burning because your insulin's going to be high and you have no choice. If you're primarily getting your calories from fat and protein and insulin's low, well, if you're eating fat, you're burning fat because fat doesn't increase insulin. So if you want to be a fat burner, you want to keep your insulin low. And that is done through a low carb diet and fasting.
There you go. In a nutshell, guys, low carb and intermittent fasting.
Yep.
I love it. Well, this basically concludes our podcast. Unfortunately, hopefully I could bring you back. I wanted to talk about your book. Dr. Ben, why don't you tell us? Well, I'll try to bring him back so we could talk about the book. You guys, it's phenomenal. If you have not purchased the book, it's called Why We Get Sick. It's phenomenal. It has great reviews. I'm going to read it because I am super interested.
You'll
I haven't gotten it yet, but I know I will. I love your everything that you talk about. And so tell them where, so your website I have over here, you could reach, you could get in touch with Dr. Ben on his website, which is?
Yep, Get Health. HLTH is the funny way to spell health. So gethealth.com is where I create blog content. And I made a low carb, high fat, high protein meal replacement shake with a couple of my brothers. And so it's a little family business. If anyone wants to learn more about the shake, gethealth.com, and health is spelled HLTH. I also, provide these, live sessions and Q&A like what I call the metabolic classroom through an online coaching platform that I am a co-founder in called Insulin IQ. And then on social media, I'm mostly actually involved on Instagram. And people can find me there on Ben Bickman. And Bickman is just B-I-K-M-A-N, no C. Ben Bickman, PhD.
Excellent. So don't worry about it. Dr. Ben is going to have a dedicated page on my website with links to his website, his social media platforms. Guys, I highly recommend Insulin IQ and his live videos. You will learn a ton. In fact, I am looking into potentially joining this. You have a, is it the Insulin IQ that... I'm sorry, what is it?
Yeah, we need to get you on as a coach. So we have coaching that we offer, flattered. But we also offer certified coaching programs to help people kind of join the Insulin IQ team to be coaches with us.
Oh, I would be, I definitely have to address some of the things that I'm addressing right now, but I would be flattered. I would be, I would love it. So guys, don't forget to check him out. Follow him. You will not regret it. I am telling you, you're going to learn so much. Hopefully we could have you again. And it's been an absolute pleasure to have you. And hopefully we could have you again.
Yep. Yep. You bet, Astrid. My pleasure. Thanks so much for arranging this.
No problem.